As an example, give me a program of something that you may have needed to encourage the farmers to pick up on and to change their farming technique.
All right, well, in the swine industry, for an example, most 90% of the hogs produced in Union County, when I were given the responsibility of the swine, were produced openly on the ground and in pastures and whatnot. And I would say when I retired, there was close to 90% of them indoors. Mm-hmm. That we had firing houses, firing crates, and fed them on the floor. Other way, from birth to the market, they never touched the ground.
Yeah.
So that was one. And some of the firing units, in particular, we didn't design any, but we took the plan that NC State has and adjusted them to some extent to what the farmers want. There are several farmers in Union County that have buildings, usable swine buildings that were not the plan that NC State gave, but it was a copy from what Bynum Driggers had. But we did it a little bit differently, and this was done because going around to various places and seeing what Bynum had to offer, so we made a change. So we from outdoors to indoors. And
why do you want your swine indoors? What's the advantage?
Efficiency. The size of unit, you limit to what you can do outdoors.
Yeah.
But you have them indoors, you can produce them to the extent that you have space for them. Outdoors, you put them out on a lot, feed them out, you got to have a lot of land, because after 2 or 3 years, this land became infested with parasites and other things.
Right.
So you have to move them, and then you're going to put a lot of feed out there that's going to waste.
Yeah.
So
you're able to control your feed when it's indoors.
You control the feed, you control the health of the animal.
Yeah.
Because you saw each animal 1, 2, 3 times a day. When they're out on the field, you may go a week without seeing some of them. But you saw every animal every day.
Yeah.
And that was necessary, because as soon as the animals start falling back, vibration of disease or anything, you were there, you saw. And that made that increased the efficiency of the producer. The size of the unit in which he operated, once they start using the building, they increased their production 100 to 500% or even more over what it was earlier.
And what are the health? I mean, on one hand, I could see where a hog would be healthier out in a free range.
No, no.
That's not right.
No, no.
But putting them all together. I would think it's harder to manage in terms of health. Well, you know, the disease would be more concentrated.
Well, now, if you have them out loosely at the way you're talking about, they may be healthier, but they'll grow slower, and it take longer to get them to market. It doesn't necessarily mean that the disease would be controlled, because if the disease is out there, you have no way of combating it. But if there's a disease that's in the confinement, you can disinfect that area and kill everything, so you can start all over new.
Mm-hmm.
See, you can start with a new building any day, any month that you want, by cleaning everything out and thoroughly disinfect that building, clean it up real good.
Yeah.
You have almost a new environment. See, you at the level that a hog can reach, you have concrete or metal, no wood or nothing like that. You have concrete or metal. So you clean that up, you have removed all the harmful bacteria or whatnot that would be there. And so you could do a much better job indoors.
Complete certainty, you know, you've got a disinfectant.
And you see now, because now we don't, most of the farmers that produce hog then are not in the business now.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's things have changed.
Yeah.
Dr. Spruill and I, when I visited him in December in Georgia, we were talking about that what we did back then was the right thing then, but it is not the right thing now.
Yeah.
Because we knew then, and we talked about it, as to when swine production would be on contract, similar to the way poultry is. We didn't think it would come so fast, but it's here, and that's what we have.
Is it big in Union County as well?
No, it isn't that big here as it is as well. And I don't know, well, I do know it isn't that big here. I don't know of the volume that is here now. It is not what it was.
Right.
It's less than it used to be.
It is. What are other kinds of, I've spent a little bit of time in the Mississippi Delta in Holmes County, Mississippi. And I was, had stayed with a black farmer in his house while I was doing some research. And he was telling me of just a real thriving community of black farmers at one point in Holmes County, which had, by the time I was there in the mid-1990s, had dwindled down to just a handful of farmers where he could count on, you know, both hands the number of active black farms, but it had really been decimated from hundreds down to, you know, a handful. And I'm wondering what the experience here was.
It's the same thing or worse. We have now. Since I retired, I've said 5 years after my retirement, 90% of the contact that I had with farmers ended. I mean, 90+%,
sure.
95% or 98%. So I know very little agriculturally now, and often people are still calling me about agricultural information. I said, not me. I said, I would tell you what was 20 years ago. I said, that isn't anymore. I don't know. But a lot of the land that was there, a lot of the black farmers lost. A lot of it has been lost.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was sold. When the mom and papa reached age, they didn't have that constant contact with the Cooperative Extension Service as they once had. So the guidance wasn't there, and the offspring scattered, so they sold it. Somebody come up off them of what they thought was a good price,
right,
and they sold. And so a lot of land that was in the hand of black people is no longer there. And secondly, they couldn't, going back in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, they couldn't borrow the money to expand. So when you reach the point now that where you made a living on that 100 acres of land, you can't even begin to come close to doing that now. It takes 1,000 acres. So you were unable to expand when the expansion was available. You didn't get the information you needed that would enable you to. So you lost what you have.
Mm-hmm.
Some are still there. They maintain the land. They rent it to others, but a lot of it was lost.
Yeah.
And you had, in this area of the state, we had 85, 6, and long that time, we had extremely dry weather. And we had hundreds of acres that were planted and never harvested. You put all the money in the ground and harvest nothing.
Didn't have the money to harvest.
But it wasn't anything to harvest. The dry weather, that's the crop was lost.
Yeah.
I mean, completely lost.
Is it? I don't know, was it mostly cotton as far as the cash crop here?
No, here with the soybean, cotton there, but cotton is just about 5 years old in Union Cannon.
No, I didn't realize that. I knew driving in, I saw a lot of cotton fields.
Cotton there, well, maybe a little bit more than five. I would say maybe 10 years old, but cotton is expanding each year. But now, prior to that, from about 60 until 1965 to 1990, wasn't in the Cotton Union County. But in the 50s, we had 40, 50,000 acres of cotton. And in the 60s and 70s, we may have had 20 acres of cotton. And then now we are back up again to large acres.
How has it come back?
Two things. It controlled the boll weevil and mechanized. Those are the two answers.
Yeah.
And no other way you can put it except those two. You can, and you have better herbicides too that you can control weeds.
And I'm guessing they're not family-owned cotton farms.
Not anymore.
No. Who are the big owners in the companies in the area?
Correct. In Union County, mostly farm family owned, but it's just a few families. That's controlled at all.
Thousands of acres.
That's right.
Yeah.
And
would these be old Union County families?
Or? Yeah, all this would be Union County families. Very few. I don't know of any. It could be, but I don't know of any successful or sizable farmer in Union County except a native of here.
Okay, so not newcomers.
No, newcomers. No, these are people who.
But
have
I'd
been
imagine
here.
They're they have pretty strong linkages with. Outside financing.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And if the point that bothers me is that if you have a dry year, and we've had two or three of them in a row, but in 2001, we had a dry year and reasonably good crops. And I don't know how in the world that the crop were as good as they were with the weather as it was. Now, what happened, it rained seldom, but the rain fell when it had to fall.
Okay.
And the crop was, it wasn't a bumper crop, but it was close to average.
Yeah.
And that's, but now had last year 2001 been a failure, a lot of other farmers would have been gone. We had fellas here now who used to be the big farmers are no longer in agriculture because those dry years and the price of farm commodities is horrible. You're getting the price for farm commodities now that you got 40 years ago. And the price of producing it multiplies. And so you get, it just means that it's difficult to survive. And I'm afraid that the land here will be cultivated by fewer and fewer people each year.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happening in Union County also that's having an impact on it is that when we were producing all of those acres, we had a population of about 72,000 to 84,000 people. Now it's 123,000.
In Union County.
Yeah, in Union County.
And where's that growth been? Has it been in Monroe and
Most of it west of Monroe, between Charlotte and here.
People coming out from Charlotte.
That's right. They're leaving Mecklenburg County and moving here.
I see.
And somebody, I don't have this officially, but I was in a meeting last fall, and one person who has more knowledge population-wise as to where people are migrating from, saying that 7 out of 10 people that migrated to Monroe, to Union County, came from Mecklenburg County. That's a pretty high percentage, but I doubt if it's quite that high, but it proof that a lot of them are leaving there, coming here.
Right.
And one of the big reasons is school. See, we are still well, we have a lot of improvement to do. The gap between the black and white in Union County is larger than it is, more than other counties.
Is that right?
Yeah. And you're putting a lot of expenditure of fund in the west of Monroe, and that's where the schools are going up, and that's where the people are coming in. East of Monroe, the population in some areas east is less than it was 10 years ago. But west is many times over.
As far as, are the schools fairly well integrated, or did they, in the wake of the 60s, did they set up the white academies here as well?
They've got white academies. But, you know, we had a unique experience in Monroe.
What's that?
In the 60s, we had a school to burn. The black school burned. So you had to integrate.
Wow.
And it worked.
Even before Charlotte?
No, Charlotte was integrated. It was
right.
That, but, see, you didn't have the hassle and the hostility. Because in the city of Monroe, you had a city school system then and a county school system. But in the city school system, the black school burned in the spring. So in the fall, they had to go to the white school.
What year was that about?
I don't know. It was in the late 60s.
Okay.
But it was, you still hear people say today that who set that fire?
Wondering about that.
and I don't think you would ever hear who set that fire, ever know who
right.
set that fire. But I'm convinced that Mother Nature didn't set that fire.
Uh-huh.
I'm convinced that that was not an electrical shortage. That's right. I'm totally convinced that that fire had some help, but it worked. The school, that the part that was burned was old and kind of dilapidated.
Right.
So you didn't lose that much. You need to rebuild it anyway. So it just worked. But then you had more of the academies to spring up. And now the school, I guess, in Monroe is 60-70% black.
Mm-hmm.
And in some schools in the county, it's about 3 to 6%, or maybe 10% the highest.
Yeah. And in terms of the town's population, what would the racial breakdown?
Racial breakdown now, you have about 25 to 28% black, and we are saying 15% Hispanic, but it's more than that.
Wow.
And but in the county, we are about. Somewhere between 12 and 14. I haven't seen the latest figure. We were 16% in the 1990 census. I haven't seen the 2000 figure.
And the town would be a little bit more African-American than the larger county.
Yeah, but point is now, Monroe is began. The percentage in Monroe of black may be less because you've annexed areas, some of the areas are 90% white, or 95% white, and those areas are being annexed and a part of the city. But being one of the 40 counties that the civil rights people have some control of, you had to get permission before you can annex anything.
Uh-huh.
And it's pretty obvious that, and I made it rather emphatically clear, if it ever reached the point that Monroe would not vote to elect black qualified candidate, I would be the first one to be on the step of the civil rights office saying that we should have district representation.
Mm-hmm. So you're all elected citywide?
That's right. And this is the way we want it. We had to go to the Justice Department to be able to continue this.
I see.
Others go to the Justice Department to get this.
Right.
And we had to go through that, to go there to avoid this because we were annexing a large area.
Uh-huh.
And it was 90%+ white. And it was reducing our ratio from 32.3% down to about 28%. And they were not going to move. Now, here's kind of one of the unique thing about that. when we went to the Justice Department to get this done, the person, we didn't speak to the head, but this was possibly a second tier leadership attorney with the Justice Department. But he knew one of the attorneys with the Justice Department that handled that was involved in our suit.
Okay.
And they used to run together. And after everybody from Monroe, we went up there to meet them after everybody left. He asked me, "Do you live in Monroe? Do you know related to the Basemo that was involved in that suit?" And then when I told him that I am that Basemo, and I had already stated in the meeting when everybody was there that if the day ever come that Monroe would not vote for a black candidate, I would be there to ask that they give district representation. Yeah. So when he and I talked, I guess about 10 minutes after everybody else was gone, and I said, "Do what you can for us." I said, "If you put us in district, you would be doing us an injustice." I said, "We would get less." I said, "Black people would get less in district than they're getting there." And that's a fact.
Yeah.
And he said, "I will do everything I can to help you."
Mm-hmm.
And we got it. So now when we get rid of annex area, phone ring, I almost know it's Justice Department. Said, "Mr. Basemo, yeah, what about this?" I said, "They may not want to be annexed, but we want to annex them." And said, "If that's going to impact the strength of the black population voting right with this," I said, "No, it isn't going to have any bearing on this." And so far, none of the election has done this. You have a unique situation here in Monroe, that because some of the areas being annexed are gradually coming up to that role. To give you an example, when we were in that suit, this week the paper said Phil Basemo, P.E. Basemo, candidate for city council. Next week, P.E. Basemo, suit against the state. And I had friends here, from all over the state said during that time, said, "Basemo, you can't be elected to be a dog catcher." He said, "You coming out all this stuff about the suit,
right.
You are charging white people for discrimination, and you think you're going to be elected?" But I was.
Yeah.
And the caliber people that did that today are still here. I mean, it's when I try to explain to some of my friends who live elsewhere of the caliber of people that live here, and this is Jesse Hamilton too, a native here, reason from here, they look at me and say, "How can that be?" I said, "I don't know." But when I tell them about the suit and I was elected, everybody accept.
Uh-huh.
They accept. They say, "Well, you have a unique situation there, but the people here, I'm talking about natives. I'm not talking about those who migrated here. The natives here, people who have spent a lifetime here, are just outstanding people."
Mm-hmm.
We have quality here, I think, and a race relationship that I think is superior to most. Now, there are some blacks and some whites here that were said just the opposite. But if you apply yourself here, now, in the past 15 years, we'll go beyond that, because from the time I've been on the council,
yeah.
It's been really open.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came on the council, I think there were two persons serving on committees. And now they're all over the place.
Yeah.
And nobody thinks anything about it. A chairman of one committee, told me today, here was a young lady, he met her recently, but said the way she talks and the way she seemed to be knowledgeable, I'd like to have her on my committee. And we have rotating committee. When I came on the council, we did not have rotating committee. As I said, there were two blacks, and I was one of them. But the chairman of the committee was chair until he decided to get off.
Okay.
And if when somebody else got on, he decided who would come on. And so when I came on the council, I said, we need to do it differently. Yeah, we need to have rotation. And they formed the committee, Lynn Kazai, who was elected the same time and I was, and then clerk, Lynn Kazai, the clerk and I, were the three people on that committee. And we came back, I told them we need a rotating system. So we came back and recommended that. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of them on the council then that said it wouldn't work. But it wasn't long before they said that was the best thing that could happen. Yeah. And we have been doing that ever since.
Kind of opening up the process.
That's right. And you're getting so many more people involved. Right. And it makes it a lot easier to govern, even though we spend a lot more time, because that's the complexity of the city government now is much more than it was 20 years ago. I think we kind of estimate that we were getting close to $1 an hour when I was elected, but we're getting considerably less now, considerably less than $1 an hour. Yeah. So if you were here to try to make a dollar, forget it. Yeah. You don't get it. You're here because you want to serve.
Right. And this. Well, 20 years, I'm wondering if you could sort of give me the highlights of your 20 years on council. Is there a particular
I don't know if there is any highlight. There's been that thing that, see, we're not guilty of the thing we are accused of. See, there are people in Monroe now who would say that Lynn Kazai and I control the thing. We don't. But we are the oldest two on that. Not in terms, I'm the oldest by age, but right. I'm talking for tenure, we are the oldest two. And that's the basis in which they say that, but that is not true. People on the outside, that is not the truth. But I don't know what would be the highlight.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I am real strong on, I think I played part of a major role in getting emphasis put on educating our school children to, you know, in North Carolina, municipalities have nothing to do with schools. Mm-hmm. But my contention is, forget about who had the responsibility. Look at the youth that need help. And we are doing some work in that area, and that's something that I feel proud of. The Head Start in Union County now, 75% of the Head Start is in facilities owned by the county, by the city. And the city has put in, built another structure recently, about $750,000. Now, not the county, but the city. And Head Start is a county federal program, not a city. The city doesn't have anybody on the board. All the county, a third of the board members are county people. I mean, county commissioners represent a third of the board. The city represents none. But it's no problem that if that interest, somebody has to spearhead those kind of things. And we have what we call the CDC Community Development Corporation that concentrate on affordable housing. We brought that in, the county and the city bought into it. We haven't been able to sell it to the county, but the city bought into it, and we're supporting that organization strenuously. So those are some of the things that I'm not too old that are done, the rotation of the committee. I mean, I don't care what happened. It is done more collectively. We have now, we used to have a committee where the court, somebody was head of a court enforcement. But now we've changed that and we had a staff member that came up with the idea of a land development committee. Lynn Kazai chaired that committee because I serve on it. But we put myself what would go in the court. Now the housing stock today isn't as good as it's going to be tomorrow, but it's better than it was yesterday. And when in most places about level, sometimes it's deteriorating. But we are requiring something that the developers don't like. If Lynn and I always use this statement that we aren't trying to win popularity contests. And we make certain that the quality of houses that are being built in the city of Monroe are going to meet standards. And then we don't allow people just throw up something, rent them, and they fall apart. They have to have quality there. And one of the big things that happened not recently, that should have happened years ago, Lynn and I and one of the staff that she's no longer here but head of the planning department, we were riding out, went to an area, predominantly black, where they had all nice brick veneer houses and gravel drive. And I said, that's disgusting. And we stopped and looked at that and said, right then, it was that day that we decided to bring before the Land Development Committee the idea that all drive from here on in, I don't care where you build a house, every drive has to be hard surface. You couldn't use anything else. Now, the developers raise a fit. There are a lot of people who are not developers. They convinced them that we were going to price them out of a home. But
is that for new construction?
New construction, all new construction.
So everyone else is grandfathered.
Everything else is grandfathered. If it's already there, that's it. But every new construction, whether it's the infill lot or whether if it's a development, we even put more than that on that. But if it's the infill lot, we don't change it from R8 it stays there because it's grandfathered there. But you still got to put that infill, that hard surface drive. And that makes a big difference. It's a little thing, but it makes a big difference. Right. And then any development that you build, if you're going to build it, we dictate the size of house. You can't put a house but so small. And there has to be a two-car garage or carport. And there has to be stories. Mm-hmm. You can provide it attached or unattached. But these are some things that we say would just have to be. And we are being criticized. But being on the team that make this happen is some of the thing that we think real stronger. And I think we have now, Lynn Kazard chair that, and he's chair of the Civic Center Committee too. But we have an aquatic and fitness center that we named recently the fitness center part of it, the Lynn Kazard Fitness Center, because he spearheaded that. But all of us were there, and it's one of the best operated aquatic and fitness center in the state. When we built that about 4 years ago, we would sweat and say, if we can get 2,500 members, we could break even. And our goal was to do that in 2 years. We reached that in less than 6 months. And now we're up to about 900 members.
Where's the center?
It's near the mall.
Okay.
I'd like to take it out there before you leave. Just run by there.
Yeah, we could do that.
And I'd like to take it by where we're going to build a civic center, that we're working on this. And it's going to be a real meaningful civic center. Possibly we will have a... We don't know where we have a theater connected with it or not, but a performing arts center will probably be included in the civic center.
And the numbers suggest that you can support this, I mean, the demographics.
Yeah,
annexations and the influx.
We do that from a whole county.
Yeah.
Even though it's done in Monroe, the financial obligation is strictly Monroe.
Yeah.
But we not only Union County, but on the Aquatic and Fitness Center, we have them coming here from South Carolina even.
All right.
So they're coming here from every place. And the fee there is less than any place else, and we haven't changed the fee yet, and no reason to, because we're operating in the black. There's a net there, size of a net each year, and it's operating.
Yeah. Well, coming down here, you know, I guess the only two things I knew about Union County were Jesse Helms' connections And the other thing would be the little bit I know about Robert F. Williams, and does Jesse Helm still have family connections here?
I would think so. I don't know of his family here, but
I saw there's a Helms, an attorney, just off the square.
That had nothing to do with that. But if you come in on 74 in Wingate, he has a Helm Center. I mean, a huge structure.
What goes on at the center?
Well, you get some of the most outstanding people in the country who are speakers here before. You name them, and Secretary of State, everybody.
Is that right?
Yeah, they come
so
here.
So it's like an auditorium of some kind?
Well, embarrassed, and I shouldn't say that on tape, but I haven't been in it yet. But but eventually I will have to. But you know, the city manager, the mayor, and I went to Washington a couple of weeks ago, maybe a little bit more than that. We need some help financially, and we're working with a group, kind of a lobbyist group, that's helping us to do this. And they schedule a meeting with Senator Helm, Senator Edwards, mm-hmm. and Representative Hayes, Robin Hayes. Edwards told me he would not be available, so we did not see Senator Edwards. But the most cordial person that you would ever see was Senator Helm.
I've heard this before.
I couldn't believe it. Now, 15 years ago, that same Senator Helm, we scheduled a meeting with him during the National League meeting there, and the one or two other municipalities, and he all but turned his back on us, and then addressed the issue that we asked at all.
Right.
But after we came back, we reported to the press, so he sent somebody down here to correct it.
Okay.
But my point is, he was unreal. I mean, it was an experience that I will always remember.
Yeah.
He was just fantastic. And I believe that anything he can do to help us, he's going to.
Yeah.
But that was a good experience.
Isn't that something?
That's a good experience. And you read in the paper that he kind of wished he had done more about the HIV/AIDS
right.
and whatnot. And I was saying that the same man that I knew. And then when I went up and met him, I'm sorry, but it's there. I mean, he may not have changed, but I'll tell you, you couldn't convince me that he hasn't.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fantastic.
So maybe he's just getting older, coming to the end of his
career? You know, I think the end of his career may be a factor. And I'm not sure, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
It's just hard to put my hand on. But you know, I think about George Wallace. George Wallace was a decent man racially. Then he got beat in an election, so he became an extreme racist
mm-hmm.
and got shot, and he turned and went back to Alabama and reversed right. himself. So I don't know. You don't know, I think sometime, well, I talked with some people from Alabama, and then they said one of the best persons we have that we ever had in the governor's chair, George Wallace, because he had changed so much from what he was. So I don't know. Jesse hadn't been shot, not by a gun. But I think the man is just as sincere as he can be.
Yeah.
And I really admire him now. I didn't admire his attitude before.
Sure.
But when he goes out, if people who get to see him and sit with him now are going to have a different attitude about Jesse Helm than the people who don't get that opportunity
right.
because it's a different person.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fantastic.
So he doesn't currently have a home in Union County?
No,
or
I think
would you have known his father, who I think was sheriff?
No, he was sheriff of 5 months. Yeah, sheriff. Yeah, ever before I came here.
Yeah.
When I first got to know Jesse Helm, not in person, it's when he was on television in Raleigh.
Yeah.
And, whew, Well, when I go there and turn on television, see that, I flip it off. But it was horrible.
Yeah.
And to see that man on television, see this man today, it's unreal.
Yeah.
And but I'd rather for a person to die right, to live wrong and die right, than to live right and die wrong.
Yeah.
I like to think that in the end, he's going to do something that's going to make up for much of what he had done otherwise. And I think this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
I'm convinced of it. Okay, what's your next question?
Well, your time would have, you got here and before, right about the time, I think Robert Williams was.
Robert Williams' activity, I think, was 60. I came here at 54.
Mm-hmm. So you would have lived through all of that here in Monroe. And I mean, tell me a little bit about what that was like.
Well, let me go back to after Robert Williams left here. And setting us with white people, when this was kind of heated, he was in, he's in Cuba, China.
Right.
But I would constantly, I made a statement fairly frequently that the one of the better things that happened to Monroe was Robert Williams. And, you know, sometimes people, white people in particular, would kind of look at me and see what's wrong with him. But then I said, what he taught all of us, that the importance of race relations.
Yeah.
I said, had he not been here, we would have had the same burning and the demonstration that other municipalities had. I said, but because he came through here, because he did what he did and you had all of this, I said, we realized that it was more important to sit down and see if we can work out some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I said, so we didn't get to that point.
Right.
Now, during that time, this is the thing that bothered me, and I still think about it now, and I realize that we could have had greater gain in Monroe and Union County than we currently have. But we started off, then you had biracial committees,
mm-hmm.
and we would meet regularly. We had a beautiful committee, I guess about 10, 12 blacks and about 15, 20 white.
Mm-hmm.
After a short period of time, that would be 10 or 12 white, one black, sometimes two blacks.
What was happening? Why would that happen?
I can never put that together. I never could understand why they no longer would come.
Yeah.
Insecurity. Felt that the white people were not sincere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, see, all of that I think was wrong. But I would still go, and I can remember Claude Eubanks, who used to be vice chair of the bank, American Bank and Trust at that time. He made a statement to me that I thought, the late Claude Eubanks, that I thought was meaningful. This is tied into with the Robert Williams era. And he said, I had some fellows that worked with me on my farm, and they said, Mr. Claude, said if you were black one weekend, you wouldn't ever want to be white again. And he said, they're happy. And I smiled and looked at him. I said, Mr. Eubank, I said, we learned a long time ago from slavery, we can get more from you if we say what we think you want them to say. I said, they didn't mean that at all. I said, after you left, they said everything just the opposite. I said, they did not mean that. And they said, well, what do they want? And I said, you look in the mirror. And he said, what do I want? I said, they want the same thing. I said, that's the best way I know to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
I said, but they felt, they think that they can get more from you. You would do them, be fairer to them if they said a thing to you that they think you want them to say. I said, that had nothing to do with the way they're thinking. And the thing that impressed me is that Claude Eubanks realized at that moment that that was the situation.
Yeah.
He never questioned anything else. And he was instrumental at Central United Methodist Church had a special program at night,
okay,
at Sunday night, and he said, you have to come and speak to us. And it was no such thing as us going there then, but I went there, here one black, blue was there with a group of white folks sitting around, and I just put the cards on the table. But following Robert William Aram, well, let's go back to the time you had the riot here.
Mm-hmm. This would have been the swimming pool riot?
Yeah, on that. And see, you had a lot of people from outside of Monroe,
right,
came to Monroe that time for everything. But my point is, to show you how stupid I was, when all of this was taking place on television, to my wife and I said, let's drive across town. We lived then, this was 1960.
Mm-hmm.
We, 60, 61, we drove, when the year it was, we were 60, I believe, because we drove from, I think the real ride must have been 61, because we were living over on the southwest side of town. We had moved from the northeast side. Northeast was predominantly black. The southwest had black, but not as many. And when all this was going on uptown, a lot of these white folk come out of town, but I came right through town. And after 2 years after that, I said, now that was stupid. But back then, I always said that you can't defend yourself in a situation like this. And I always thought about what I would do. I said, I'm going to make certain that everybody would know who did it. And I kept Drano in my car all the time. That was the weapon. And anybody that started anything with me, Drano was going in his face.
Mm-hmm.
And you would know that that was the person.
Right.
So, but nothing ever happened.
Yeah.
And I went to some places out in the northeast part of the county, a little later than that. I said, never happened. There was no reason for it, but I went with that Drano,
mm-hmm,
to do that.
Right.
But I think Robert William, and I still believe that his contribution to Monroe is far greater than what black or white will ever say.
Yeah.
I think the race relationship here would not be as good today if he hadn't come this way.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that way strongly. And I've said that in many settings.
Right.
I said it back then when it wasn't popular to say,
yeah,
but it was my firm belief, and I still believe it, that he is part of the reason that we decided we need to sit down and discuss issues. And as I was telling about Claude Eubank, but there are other people that First Baptist Church had me to meet with their men one Sunday morning. But all of this was because we sat down and talked about issues of what we need to do and how we can get it done.
Yeah.
And the thing that, a little after that, that surprised me, I can't think of the fellow's name, but he was the executive director of the Chamber of Commerce. And that's when we was there, before we merged our office. And his office was in the Big Belt building. We was in the Corporate Extension Service, had that little building behind that for us. And he and I was talking one day, and he said, Bazemore, you won't believe this, but we had a conference with our board of directors, chamber board, and we decided who were the most radical black person in in Union County, or Monroe. And I said, well, and he said, you know who they said was? Well, I said, what? He said, you? I said, what? He said, yeah. He said, but before you start running wild, let me say this. He said, this guy is radical, radical, but he does it with common sense. And said, as long as you do things with common sense, nobody can hate you for it. But he said, they said, you are the most radical black person in town. And I laughed. I said, I didn't know I was radical. But see, the suit and all that stuff was picking up.
Right.
And so I was a radical person. But I never lost respect of the leadership, black or white, in Monroe, yeah. Union County. Mm-hmm. And so that happened. But Robert Williams was, in my opinion, played a role in this.
Yeah.
And if any recognition for him, and I think there will be some, but I think black, white people would not get involved even today. Black people will do it, may do it anyway, but it will be for, in my opinion, the wrong reason. Not the greatest thing, they'll do it for something else, but his greatest contribution, I think, was race relationship in Monroe.
Was it that the way it worked was that white people saw what the alternative was?
Yeah.
If they did.
That's right. It was the kind of thing that this thing of meeting together started in Washington, of course. But they realized once this race riot happened that this, and people all over were burning buildings and all that,
right.
that this could easily happen here. And there were times when it was could reach that point. Because I know that I was involved, we were involved in meeting, and a group was supposed to come here from Chicago and everywhere, other place, elsewhere. And we said no. He said, they'll come here, some of our young hothead would be killed, yeah. and they're going back. I said, so we were meeting to prevent that. But we had, and I'm convinced that all of these weren't white. I think we had some black people that contributed to this, because I was one of those persons that was supposed to be involved in bringing the people here yeah. that's going to create a noise. And they said that meeting, the name of the meeting, the city manager then, county manager, rather, I was with the Quabbin Extension Service, he named the meeting. I said, what? I said, at that meeting, number one, I was not presiding.
Yeah.
I said, I'm not the chair. I said, but let's get one thing straight. I said, now, that meeting, we put together an organization to discourage local people from getting involved if they come. I said, now, we can't prevent them from coming, but we were putting together an organization to discourage local participation. I said, but this is what we get. I said, I'm going to get one thing straight. I said, if they come here and decide they're going to burn this city down, I said, I'm going to take my wife and child and get the hell out of town and let them. And I said, I'm not going to do a damn thing yeah. to prevent it or nothing. I said, I'm through.
Yeah.
I said, when you're trying to do what is good and then you come up with this kind of crap, I said, I'm through. And he said, wait. I said, no, you've already said enough. And
so this was about the time that the, was it SNCC volunteers came in and people from CORE?
They were coming in,
right.
but they never came here to the extent that they were planning to come.
Oh, I see.
It never happened.
Uh-huh.
They were.
Because I know Mr. Williams did, you know, encourage some
yeah.
people, a few, you know, outside organizers mm-hmm. to come in.
But that, I'm talking about after he left.
This was later. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
yeah, after he left. But while he was here, yeah, the some came in. But after he left, this is what
yeah.
what popped up.
Did you know him personally?
Yeah.
And what do you, what sort of reflections do you have on him, just interpersonally?
Well,
seems to have been a really unique individual.
He was unique. Robert has, he was bitter.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody white did him or somebody close to him a terrible injustice, and that bitterness was there, mm-hmm. and he couldn't shed it. It was a part of his personality. And but he wanted to see progress today rather than to go along a little bit slower.
Right.
It was, he wanted to see what you would get in 2 years, he wanted to see it in 2 days. I mean, that's just about the way he wanted it. And somewhere between 2 days and 2 years, what you end up getting. Uh-huh. And he was a forceful person.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced that a lot of people here are convinced. And we have no idea who was involved, but he got out of town. That a white person locally got him out of town.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Somebody that you suspect, or?
I will never call that name, but yet the answer is yes. And don't ask, because I'm not going to say
it. I won't ask.
But some of us think we know who was instrumental in getting him out of town.
Because they wanted him out of town? No, because they
were a sympathizer. No, they thought that they reached a point then that there could be some racial problem. If they could have gotten him there, to think some white person would have shot him.
Yeah.
And they thought that to prevent him from being harmed, they got him out of town. Not to prevent him from doing what he was doing, but to save his life.
Okay.
And that's it. We are convinced that a white person moved him out, and that kept that scar from being on Monroe. Mm. But just moved him right out of town.
Right.
And financially and everything, and got him on his first journey. So my point is, there's always been some real downright good people in Monroe.
Yeah. I know that early on, he had some support from people like the Boyd family.
Yeah.
Have you seen the recent biography, the Radio Free Dixie, that's been done on Robert Williams?
No, I heard about it, but I didn't see it.
But that I was surprised to read about. You know, even in the mid-50s, that he and Harry Boyd and some other people through the Unitarian Church, I believe, have been talking about race relations.
Well, he was NAACP chairman, I think, for a while, and he was working with Dr. Perry and others. But William was doing a lot of good things here all along.
Yeah.
Some of we were a little ahead of the game, but we had some black people who said Martin Luther King was ahead of his time.
Right.
But my point is, if not now, when? And this is the kind of thing, I thought Martin Luther King was doing it as slow as you would go, but that's, you wouldn't go slow enough. That was too slow for Robert Williams.
Right.
And even Malcolm X was not moving as fast as he wanted to go.
Right.
And so, but you take that combination of people and you get a lot of things accomplished. At that time, the people that ran away from Robert Williams would run to others, and then you end up pulling something together.
Yeah.
He was a tremendous, he made a tremendous contribution to race relations in Monroe, and I still believe that part of it is still here. I don't think that the race relationship would be as good today had he not come this way.
Did you know Mrs. Williams, Mabel Williams?
I didn't know her as well. I knew her, but I didn't know her as well, no.
You know, he had some close supporters in the neighborhood. Mm,
yeah. I knew the supporters. One fellow that, I'm trying to think of his name now, helped me in my first campaign.
Yeah.
But
I'm not sure if they're still here.
Most of them are dead or gone. Yeah, most of them are dead. But this there are still some people who criticize him for going to Cuba, for going to China. If he hadn't gone there, where could he have gone? I mean, I was anti-Cuba, anti-China, but if not there, where? See, he had to survive.
Right.
He had to do some of the things he did. I don't think he was interested in doing exactly what he did, but he did what he had to do to survive.
You say there may be some kind of, you think at some point, some memorial
I think so. I think a scholarship or something like that will come up.
You had, think you'd mentioned you didn't think that most whites would be too interested in that.
No, but I think
how do they look back and remember the Robert Williams?
I think though we will be able to get some of them to put a sizable contribution to a scholarship fund in his name. But just right now, I mean, it would take another effort. And it would take an effort from somebody that those white individuals respect. You point out just what I've just said, that the value of Robert Williams was to this community. And I think we'll get some, if the scholarship fund is developed, and I think it will be, because I think I'm going to be play a small role in doing this. I would not play the leadership role, but the person that had mentioned it, and I was in the meeting, and I said, I think that's a splendid idea. Yeah. And I think it's going to develop. And if we get it developed, I think we will get some sizable contribution from some of the white people.
Yeah.
And but it was just, now that's what I call a radical. He was a radical.
Right.
And when he said I was a radical, you see how I kind of had to step back. But now he was a radical. But he was a radical for justice.
Yeah.
And people lose sight of that. He was a radical for justice. Mm-hmm. And that's wrong with that.
Let me switch gears slightly.
Okay.
I wanted to get back to your case. We didn't even go over your, you know, this is a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And this was after, the state, I guess would it be the federal district court?
Yeah.
Had rejected
mm-hmm.
your suit.
And the appellate court, I guess one in Richmond, was a 3-1 rejection.
Mm-hmm.
But that one, who was also from Chapel Hill, he was tied with that, and he was the one that said we had legitimacy, and that's how it got to the Supreme Court.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you went up to hear the argument. When would it have been, 1985 or 85?
Yeah.
Was the argument,
that's right.
Since the decision.
Right.
Tell me what that was like in the U.S.
That's the one and only time in my life that I can say outright that my heart stopped beating. Now, people look at it and say, what are you talking about? But you're sitting there, you're calm, others are coming forth. It's not exciting, but when they walked out there, it's at Baysmore versus Friday, and I really believe my heart quit right then and there. Now, I don't know why, but for a few seconds, nothing about me was normal. I couldn't breathe, I couldn't, with nothing. And then a few seconds it came back. It felt like a long time, but it had to be just a few seconds. But it was a frightening experience. It's something that I still haven't been able to adequately describe it, but you were there at the U.S. Supreme Court. They've already heard a couple there, and you sitting there, why that going on? And then this comes up, your name is called in that body of people. It was just frightening, but it was an experience. That's one experience nobody forgets. Don't let anybody kid you. Nobody forgets that. But we were there. We were in Richmond,
right.
And we were there. Wherever they went, we were there.
But particularly, to hear your name named in the suit, and then also with the work that you put into it, it must have been, in some ways, you have a real sense of pride. And
after that, I mean, that was pride. I don't know what it was that drove me to doing it. But, you know, let me back up a little bit. When I was a boy, white children had buses to go to school. Black children walked to elementary school, and they didn't have transportation to high school. When I was a boy, my father bought a bus, and I think he was charging 5 cents or 10 cents a week or something like that. But he would, and half the people didn't pay him. But he was taking people to high school, and that's how some of them got to go to high school. And at one day, my mother was there. And Dad was kind of a quiet guy. He wanted to do things, but he didn't make a lot of noise. But my mother had people winding all around, loading that little bus, hanging everywhere. And they drove by the superintendent's office, get attention so they can get some buses for black folks. Now, that had nothing to do with the fact that that happened. The state just did it, but my point is, when it's to talk about demonstrating and whatnot, I said, look, my family been demonstrating long ago. Yeah. But that's way back when I was a little boy in elementary school. I wasn't in high school. I was in elementary school. My two oldest brothers were in high school. But I was in elementary school. But that kind of thing happened. But then when you come back to where we are, to the Supreme Court, it's a frightening experience, but at the same time you realize that you've gone this far. Of course, I had retired then. I said, so we need to go as far as we can. And I admire the quality of legal help that we had. I mean, I didn't think we had first class, outstanding attorneys representing us. It was no way that we could have gone that far if they didn't put in the kind of work that had to be done. They had loads of paperwork, and they worked night. So there were some nights I was up to midnight with them, and the thing that was encouraging, getting ready for the district court in Raleigh, that I could sit there and call people who had said, heck with it, they weren't going to get involved. And I can call them and say, we need you in court on Wednesday or with the court on Thursday. It never fail. Never fail. And this is the unreal. That one person who died recently, McDaniel, George McDaniel from Goldsboro, Wayne County, they said he was through. So when I called him, and he told the wife, you're going to Raleigh to testify. He said, she told him, I thought you were through with that group. He said, yeah, but Bayes called, I got to go. And he was there and did an impressive job. Yeah. But the thing that we differ from others in getting to the Supreme Court, we had a lot of us involved, not just one or two. Yeah. See, the nucleus of it was just the four or five of us.
Right.
And as chair, I made certain that nucleus, that we stayed functioned, right. We're focused, and we worked continuously. We met regularly. I don't think I had for 10 years or more that I had more than 2 or 3 days of vacation time. All of my vacation time was tied up with this. And so when I took a day of vacation, this is what we were doing. So far as taking a vacation, taking my wife and family someplace, I didn't have time for more than 10 years. But it took that to get it done. And we was able to do it. But I never thought that I would have the feeling when I got to the Supreme Court that I had. I never thought. I think it was fear, it was joy, it was a little of everything. But I think this, getting back with that case too, I was home one day and one of the attorneys who was in Washington, practicing law in Washington, called me. He said, Mr. Bazemore? I said, yeah. I said, what's he doing? I said, well, I'm sitting here reading. He said, you standing? I said, yeah. He said, well, you mind sitting down? I sat down. And he said, are you sitting now? I said, yeah. And he said, I thought you might, this was minutes after the announcement was made. He said, we won. He said, three out of the four issues won. We lost the fourth one on them, fired the four votes.
Right.
I told him, I'm glad I'm sitting, because if I would not, I'm not sure that I wouldn't go beyond the, but that's, Squire, his name, the one that he was one of the attorneys with the Justice Department. But that is a, nothing that's happened to me and associated with the Cooperative Extension Service that measured up to that one time. That would be, if there is a highlight, because I was out of the service, retired at that time, but if there's a highlight of anything that I did at the Cooperative Extension Service, whether stay with that until we got to the Supreme Court and then with that victory, because that helped a lot of black agents to be more focused. We kept stressing the idea you have to perform. You don't lose sight of that. And I think some of them were better agents, better employees as a result of that. Of course, you always find some that would be just the other way around, but right. I think some were better employees as a result of that.
What could be better affirmation of what you had been contending for 20, 30 years, you know, but to hear the highest court of the land saying, yes, you were right.
That's it. Short of dying and going to heaven, there isn't anything else. I didn't mean to put it quite that strong, but that, to me, if you're talking about utopia and on an issue of anything, that's it.
Yeah.
You don't get higher than that in this world. On an issue of that nature, that you have put so many hours, you and others have put so many hours and days in, and money. See, we put a lot of our individual money.
I was wondering about that. Did you just all finance it as individuals?
Well, see, the legal part, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, contracted with the attorneys, the last group of attorneys, and said, now you handle this, and when the suit is settled, they were going to be compensated then. Now, whether we won or lost, they were going to be compensated.
Right.
And so since we won, they would compensate out of the money that was awarded to us.
So you won on the issue of promotion.
Promotion, salary, and employment.
And employment. You lost on the issue of?
Voice Club, segregating the Voice Club, and the Home Economic Club. They said that's volunteer, it won't have to be, but four said you were wrong, five said that's it, so we lost that on the 5-4 vote.
Were the other three issues, were those 9-0?
9-0.
Is that right?
Yeah.
But they split on the integration.
That's right. And an attorney here, and I won't call his name because we were working together at that time, and I must say something on this tape that I probably shouldn't. He said, Phil, said the people in the extension service must have been kicking your ass real good for Renfrow to vote for. He said, when your Chief Justice vote this way, he said, you must have been kicked real hard.
Yeah.
And I said, well, over the years, it had been difficult. And it had been difficult, but that, to me, justified everything that we had gone through up until that time,
right.
Knowing that this was the situation and that the whole world knew that we were being done and injustice was
right.
done. But now let's back up a little bit. Before we got to the Supreme Court, under George Hyde, they did a reevaluation of the salary before he got there and closed that gap tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
And strange enough, it didn't affect me one nickel. Come on, I was already there.
Yeah.
It didn't affect me. I didn't get one nickel out of that, but it put in a bushel of money. The General Assembly or somebody made a big appropriation and kicked the salary up. So it would have been much worse. But once this got started, right, they made that
commitment. And you know they weren't going to kick those salaries up until you started organizing. No. They didn't decide from the goodness of their hearts.
This was a decision, was a defensive decision.
Right.
They knew that this was coming.
Vulnerable.
And so they were trying to close the gap in that respect. But that suit, in my opinion, another thing that has happened, once the senior law students at Chapel Hill requested I come there, so I went there and talked with a group of them once since then. But I've been asked if I would go to some other states for that. But this was a part of the coursework, law school coursework, Mississippi, Stanford.
Your case has been cited as far as case law. I know that Fordyce, Mississippi versus State of Mississippi, or a couple of cases where you're cited, and they've asked me, and I've said no, I'd rather not.
But the reason I went to Chapel Hill, because this same attorney, I can't think of his name right now, that is the reason we don't have district representation in Monroe. He is practicing law in Raleigh there.
Oh, okay.
And he called me and asked me if I would do it.
Yeah.
Now, when he said, I had no choice.
Yeah.
But I had this school, a law school at Chapel Hill call, I would have said no.
Yeah.
But when he called.
Why wouldn't you go to Stanford or Mississippi or Chapel Hill?
To me, I didn't feel that it looked like you were trying to make an issue to make me what I'm not. And I didn't want that.
Yeah.
I want it, you have it recorded. That's the way we need to let it stay. Don't try to make me what I'm not, what I was not. And what I did, it would be difficult for me to discuss it without saying something about the penalties, about what my loss. I didn't want to put emphasis on that. Somebody have pitied me. I don't want a damn pity. Right. Excuse my French, but I felt that best for me to do is not get out there, not try to say what I lost or what I did.
Yeah.
I want you to look at the case and go at it from there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really want to get down to the real roots of it, get one of the attorneys that within the suit that was involved.
Yeah.
That's, I feel that way strongly.
I think you're being modest. I mean, to play devil's advocate. You're the best living spokesman for the suit and for the experiences of why the suit came about anyway.
But that isn't important to me. What's important that the suit took place. We won it.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court said you have to correct a wrong.
Right.
That's the bottom line. That's what it was all about.
But the Supreme Court decision wasn't the end of the line, was it?
No, it has to still. He sent it all the way back, and it come back, and we lost. Each time it got started back, I mean, Richmond didn't bother with it but a little while, but once it got back to Raleigh, Manning did. And I have to say this because I feel strongly about it. Young Manning had his first experience before the U.S. Supreme Court.
And that was his first?
Yeah, his father was the head of the case.
Right.
But that was his first time at the U.S. Supreme Court.
So this is Howard Manning Sr.,
yeah.
Howard Manning Jr.
Manning Jr.
And they were representing Friday.
He didn't do too well. Howard Manning Jr. didn't do too well at the U.S. Supreme Court. And it was obvious to everybody that he was nervous. And if he wasn't, he wouldn't have been human.
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it, he was nervous. But this is the point that I'm getting to. Recently, his ruling on the school situation, the gap between the disadvantage and whatnot, what the state had to do, I was telling our state representative, that I have to go by there and shake his hand and say thank you. And she had the audacity to say, but he's a Republican. And my point is, you know, she was the Val on a Duke class. She graduated from Duke University. I never, there was other people there of her persuasion, political. And I thought maybe I was off balance, but they couldn't find out where that fit in. I mean, because you're of different parties, you don't shake hands if somebody does something. But I think he has and is doing a magnificent job. A lot of people don't agree. But I think the fact that he did and the governor said, we will not appeal, spoke highly of the governor. Mm-hmm. Because there was some stuff in there that, not being an attorney, I feel certain that they could have appealed and won.
Right.
But he said, no, we let it stay and go. But getting back to the case again, that's, I still don't know how to really express my feelings as it relate to that, but I still think that I should not be a person, I should not go out and talk about that case, except that one of the attorneys that was involved asked me if I would go here, go there, then and they're going to be there, then I would feel comfortable in going. But other than that, I don't feel, my answer would still be no. And it's been a long time ago, but my answer would be no.
Yeah. How did it play out, though, after it came back to Raleigh? What?
Well,
I mean, essentially this was, I mean, they were required then to follow the lead of the Supreme Court's directive.
Yeah, yeah, and the money's involved, but they start promoting then. But, you know, I could be totally wrong. You know, maybe I'm biased. The hypocrisy of it was, as I see it, that black women had never been a challenge to the administration. And that's who they started promoting. And they've never been a challenge. But you take agricultural counties, knowing some of the politicians from those counties, start looking down on the Cooperative Extension Service because they looked at it as being a male thing.
Right.
And the importance, and I'm convinced that some of the decline in the importance of the Extension Service on the part of the General Assembly stemmed directly from the fact that in some of those major agricultural counties, they promoted too many women as head of the county. And they are nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But you got to look at the mentality who you're dealing with. They have that mentality that these are fairly matured, or I won't say old, but men that are up in the age, and they look at something as being a man responsibility. Now, I think some women should have been promoted, but I think the ratio of female to male promotion mm-hmm. was wrong.
So they did implement structural changes
yeah.
in terms of salaries, hiring, promotions.
But actually, they didn't do much on hiring because soon after that, everything started going down. The appropriations from the General Assembly started going down. So it was just a matter of then the promotion thing happened.
Right.
That was taking place.
What about in terms of restitution and penalties?
And now restitution, they gave a lump sum. It was about $1 million, something like that, divided between, it was a class action suit.
Uh-huh.
And then the attorneys have to be paid out of that, and then the rest of it went to us.
Uh-huh. And so then you all have to figure out how to divide among yourselves as well as how to
the attorneys class. Figured that out, and we had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
We did not get in, but they figured that out and decided how much, what they were, the thing that they would put weighted issue on, and then they did that. And then,
my guess is that how many not among the class, but how many plaintiffs were there? Is 50?
About 50, something like
that. I mean, I'm imagining that the sum that you ended up with was nowhere near once it was all divided.
No,
it had
nothing
to do with the economic sanction that had been, you know, that had it cost you.
No, no, I would have done that for $1.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't that much. I think all told, it was about $20,000, something like that, that right. I got. But heck, I put more than that in it.
Yes,
right. So, that was beside the point. The point is that it had to go that way. See, I know that. If postage stamp was like this now, I wouldn't have been able to do it. But postage stamp was much less. But comparatively, postage stamp cost as much then as it do now, because
right.
your income now is that much higher. But I sent out a bushel of letters, and I made a bushel of phone calls. So it was my expanded miles traveled. No, I mean, no way. Those of us, I said about six of us, were not compensated for what we had spent. And out of that group, I think a large portion of the expenditure of money I spent it because that's share, that thing that the phone calls and the mailing
right.
I did, and the travel, all of us did travel.
And but, many of the men, of course, didn't live to see the
that's right.
final disposition. Mm-hmm.
And the thing that...
Which is absolutely tragic.
It was tragic. D.O. Ivey in Idale County was about a month before he died. And you had to put your head close to him to hear. And he said, Basemo, don't let those guys get away with it. Make certain they pay, they come up and do it. Don't let them get away with anything. And that bothered me. That bothered me. Here's a man dying. Instead of, I hope there were other times he thought of the niceties of the world, but his thought then on his dying bed was the injustice that had been inflicted on black people. Now that to me was possibly the saddest experience I had in the whole thing. That was worse than my loss. I mean, to hear a man at that level, a person who normally weighed close to 200 pounds, he weighed a little better than 100 pounds then, and you could hardly hear what he was saying. But he was said loud enough for you to know that he said, don't let them get away with it. Stay with it. Make certain they pay.
Unable to die in peace.
That's right. That was the saddest part of the whole thing, in my opinion. That out there is something that I can never forget. That feeling there, and when you left there from Stateville here, you were so sad. It was almost dangerous to be driving because I wasn't sad. I was mad. I wasn't angry. I was downright mad because here was a man angry, extremely angry for what the treatment that has been that black people had suffered. He was there dying, and that was still number one on his mind. And those are the kind of experiences that you go through in a situation like this. And it's hard to forget. With the years past, I should have forgotten most of this stuff. But when you get your rump kicked as we did, you don't forget that. It's so easy. A lot of it stays with you.
I don't know if you've seen this in a long time.
It's been a long time. It has been a long time.
This article is The Independent. And one of the points that article makes is that at some point it doesn't even seem like the state was behind this suit, that it became kind of the personal campaign of Howard Manning Sr.
The state was behind it.
They were.
Yeah. The state was totally, George Hyatt and that its extension administration was totally behind
it. They stayed.
All the way they made certain. They knew that they could make one error and it would, even George Manning would have changed.
Mm-hmm.
But as I told you earlier, when Carlton Blaylock said the 100 counties with 100 white chairmen, race had nothing to do with it. I mean, he listened to that, and I mean, accepted it. But everybody in there knew that was a lie. I mean, there was no question about it, but that was accepted. But this was, I believe we did this on St. Augustine campus, I think. This was taken on St. Augustine campus. Uh-huh. And
was it just the, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
When they came out there and started talking, I knew then, I never thought that they were going to carry, that the independents were going to carry that far, but
I thought they did a good job.
I thought so too. And one or two of the quotes, I think, in there from George Hyde said something about I had charisma, that it wasn't that bad, but I was able to get people to follow me. And no, they were so behind because they too have been kicked. So, I mean, it wasn't that. It was a matter of if you find something that you can fall in line and be a part of that could relieve you or relieve future generation of the suffering that you have had, then you just come on board. And that's what happened. But I don't know. I don't know how I would have that pose. I don't know if I could stand that way now, but the guy took several pitches. I guess it took 10 or 15 pitches, but that's the one that came out. But there was no reason for laughter, so that there were no smiles on my face, right. Even though I want to always like to grin a little bit before the camera, but that was...
I think it's an effective picture.
Thank you, thank you. But it's there was a degree of anger there, and
that's underscored with that.
And that anger preceded our court date, and it went beyond the court date. Yeah. So it's more than 18 years of anger and injustice. But that's just what it is.
How long after 89 did the actual, when was the case resolved in terms of payments made? And
it was made in the early 90s. I don't remember
that. So it still took a couple years
It was in the early 90s before it got back to Raleigh. So it took a long time. I don't know. But
the service... You think they were they were that invested that late in maintaining white power, basically?
Yeah. Then we felt, and we still feel, that the Department of Agriculture is the most racist department that you have in the country. I'm talking about from Washington on the way through. And the Extension Service is just one arm of that. But the entire Department of Agriculture, we feel, is the most racist of all of them.
That's the case that the black farmers are making.
Yeah. And they're so right. They're so true. They're so right. There are a lot of farmers today, here and elsewhere, who would be successful farmers today if the opportunity had been even close to being equal. But you would get your loan later, and you would only get half what you had to have and never what you needed. And it was a case where it was designed to make you fail. And even though that wasn't the intent, but see, black farmers didn't know how to put together a real intelligent loan application. Mm-hmm. And by the time they learned how to do this, then the interest rate got high, and those who were able to borrow it then as a result of civil rights, then they got too deep in debt, and you had some disadvantaged situation, and you lost what gain you had. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't move ahead. If you had that base to start with, then you can grow. Right. But you can't start from zero in the kind of interest rate you had and then move. But that was different. Had the loans, the money had been available to black farmers earlier, there were black farmers here who had been